want to start by remembering, by which I mean remembering, bringing back together things that are have been torn apart. Remembering that when we gather on Treaty One territory, gratefully so. We're going to be exploring some things that have to do with justice this morning. And I was listening to somebody earlier this week talking about the process of repatriating, maybe not the right word, just flat out returning artifacts of inestimable value to their countries of origin. Artifacts were extracted from those countries as part of the colonialization process. And this person was just talking about how the essence of colonizing is extraction. And that got me thinking about what happens when we extract things from the earth, and the sort of this process where we take a whole bunch of things from the earth. We keep the bits we want, the ore, the whatever it is that we thought was of value, and we kind of dump the rest to the side like a slag heap, a garbage heap. And I was just thinking about in Canadian history, the history of the interaction between the settlers, the people of European descent, the people who are my lineage, and the First Nations people of our country, and how I think we got the piles confused, you know? I think we kept the wrong stuff and threw out the wrong stuff, and we need to kind of reconsider that whole process. We extracted what we thought was of value and discarded what we thought was not of value, and pretty much just got it all wrong, in the sense that we kept the material stuff and discarded the people. And that's not as it should be. And so when I think about justice relative to a statement like being grateful to gather on Treaty One territory, that's the stuff that sort of comes along with it for me this morning. Speaking of camping trips, we're not headed out camping in particular, but we are off on some vacation together as a family tomorrow morning, so a little less stressful timeline than you're up against there today, Cheryl and Zach. But we'll be out of touch for a few weeks in terms of this community or showing up in this space. I'll you know, touch base, but not this way. And Tim Penner and Ariel and Judy are going to be taking the talkie bits, and I look forward to those, because I look forward to the things that this community shares with the community. And I know that those three folks will bring thoughtful and interesting things to us. And all of that's happening in many ways while we wait for the opportunity to be together in person. It's not what we're exploring today, but perhaps we will do that. Perhaps we will get to do that. And I say perhaps because I don't know if in my lifetime it's ever felt so clear to me that the future is not a predictable thing. I mean, we know that. We acknowledge it intellectually, at least some of the time. But every once in a while, it gets visceral, and this feels like a season like that. There's always a profound tension, I think, between this moment that we're in, the moments that are in the past, and the moments that are to come. And this is never simplistic. Even if we choose to live a simpler life, and there are some of us that are finding a renewed intrigue in that idea as this moment in history reveals some of the deep cracks in our social fabric that are there because of heedless consumption. But even if we choose a simpler life, the complexity of time remains intriguing and even baffling to us. And so in the face of a complexity like that, we might make a couple of different choices. We might choose to work at learning to live in the moment, to be present. Or maybe we're more inclined to just put our heads down and to ignore the things that baffle us and press on. Those can both be ways that we might strive to both make the most of what life has to offer and also to have the most to offer to others as we live together. But at the same time, I think we can hit a moment in history like this one, and we can feel like, you know, I don't like this present moment. I feel stalled, stuck, anxious, afraid, frustrated, a whole host of negative emotions. Why would I want to be present to this? Well, it's not a universal panacea, but part of the answer might be so the past doesn't repeat itself. That's one of the reasons to be present to this. And we're going to explore that more as we go this morning. But before we do, let's take some time to breathe together. And one of the practices that we've been sometimes blending with breathing together is the practice of interlocking our hands over the course of those cycles of breath. I would invite you, if you're joining this practice this morning, to join in that way as well. Just another way of saying with our bodies, which with our actions, which is how we need to say the good things in life. We need to find ways to enact them. Just another way of saying with our bodies, we are connected to one another. We are interlocked with one another. All right, let's do three cycles this morning. So in through our noses for a count of three, breathe deep, let the breath go all the way down into your rib cage and into your tummy, like right down into above your belt. Fill yourself right up with the life-giving air that we are privileged to breathe. Cradle your breath for a count of three and then breathe it all out through your mouth, however many counts that takes. If you're forceful, it's three. I'm less forceful, I like to take six. So three rounds of that over the course of which, again, I invite you to interlock your fingers. So as you go, all right, let's breathe together and then we'll go exploring. Here we go. Peace. I don't know what people's practice was and have no way of knowing, don't need to know, except that I wanted to comment on the practice a little wee bit. I was noticing as my fingers were moving deeper into being interlocked, that middle stage, and maybe this is just about, you know, the size of my knuckles or something personal about my anatomy, but I noticed it kind of at that middle stage that there was a you know, a glitch. There was a more difficult, less comfortable stage in that process. And then once the interlocking was deeper, it felt more at ease and more like the pieces belonged together. And it just struck me that that's maybe a metaphor for other parts of our experience of trying to learn both that we are interdependent and how we shall be interdependent, how we can practice that. It takes a little doing. Anyway, on with our particular explorer here. I commented recently in this space that prophets aren't considered prophets because they make historically accurate predictions about the future. There would be a very short list of prophets if that was the qualifier for that name of role. They are prophets. Prophets are prophets because they point out things that are broken, things that are not right. We recently had a social outing, a big deal these days, with some dear friends that we hadn't seen in person before that time with them since New Year's Eve. And I don't know about you, but I feel like I'm probably going to look back on 2020 and it's just going to feel like there's huge chunks of it that are just missing, that just got eaten up by events that were beyond my control. But in any case, in this event, we were able to say we would like to go on this day and this time and be with these people, and we were able to do it, and that felt great. And this is a pretty musical family, these friends, and their kids in particular are classically trained musicians and a bunch of good ones. One of their kids has perfect pitch. And as someone that likes to make music myself, I used to envy people with that ability. You know, you could name a note and they would just sing it just out of the air, no external references. They were never out of tune. Gah. And so I had some, you know, jealousy once in a while. But then I started to get to know some people that actually had perfect pitch, and they have helped me understand that while it may sometimes be helpful, it is more often a burden. And the reason, as they explain it to me, is that if you have perfect pitch, you can't ignore it when things are out of tune, right? You can't help but either react or respond in some way. Prophets are like people with perfect pitch for justice. If things are out of tune in the culture, they can't ignore it or just sort of keep playing along. They have to speak up. They have to try to address the problem, or they have to feel like they're, you know, like they're going to blow up if they just try to hold it in. It goes off inside of them in a way that is unique. Now, if you grew up around stories about Hebrew prophets, you know that sometimes that I can't be silent sensation comes out in ways that are noisy and disruptive of the status quo there. They feel street theater-y or activist-ish in their tone. They're those kind of expressions, and they're the kinds of things that might make the people around said prophet feel pretty uncomfortable and maybe even unsafe. The job of a prophet is not to smooth things over. In our culture, in our time, it seems like that's a job we've given to our politicians. I won't pursue that. However, as with many stereotypes, the image of the prophet as a sort of flamboyant public disruptor is not the whole story. Now, that's a legit, needed, powerful, often timely role, that disruptive one, but it's not the only way to do the job. One of the things that I really enjoy in this community is when you contact me in ways that interact with a talky bit or something else, as we've been sharing comments online with things that other people have posted and shared. But when you contact me and share something that you're thinking about or reading or that you're musing on, I really enjoy and appreciate those interactions. My sister Karen, who lives in Calgary, so she can't gather with us even when we are meeting in person, often joins us via the Facebook group or drops in later in the day from where she is to just watch along. I've mentioned several ideas from Ibram X. Kendi these past few weeks, and Karen has been reading his book Stamped: Racism, Anti-Racism, and You, which is sort of a YA remix that he co-wrote with Jason Reynolds, a remix of Kendi's original book, which was called Stamped from the Beginning: The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. So, I mean, it's not the only books Kendi's written, but that particular pair. And this week, she sent me an email that contains a quote from that book, from the Stamped Anti-Racism, and You. Now, before I read you the quote, which I'm going to do, it mentions something called Vanini's theory of polygenesis, which might not be something that's just on everybody's radar. So just a bit about that before I read the quote. Vanini was an Italian philosopher who believed that people of African descent came from, quote, a different Adam. And you have to remember that when Vanini was living and writing and thinking, the narrative that all humans came from this actual Adam was a generally accepted one in the culture. That was sort of the prevailing narrative for human origin in European culture. And so he suggests this theory of polygenesis, which is that people of African descent come from a different Adam, and as a result, we're a different species. So not human, or at least not human like white folks were human, and consequently, they didn't need to be treated the same. So that's Vanini's theory of polygenesis in a nutshell. So when we hit that phrase, maybe it'll make a little more sense. Here's the quote. I know we've been going on and on about people working to justify slavery, but it's important, very important, to note that there were also people all along the way who stood up and fought against these ridiculously racist ideas with abolitionist ideas. In this particular case, the case of Vanini's theory of polygenesis, a group of Mennonites in Germantown, Pennsylvania, rose up. The Mennonites were a Christian denomination from the German and Dutch-speaking areas of Central Europe. During the 16th and 17th centuries, Orthodox authorities were killing them for their religious beliefs. Mennonites didn't want to leave behind one place of oppression to build another in America, so they circulated an anti-slavery petition on April 18th, 1688, denouncing oppression due to skin color by equating it with oppression due to religion. Both oppressions were wrong. This petition, the 1688 Germantown Petition Against Slavery, was the first piece of writing that was anti-racist among European settlers in colonial America. Karen's email had the subject line, "Who knew?" And yes, indeed. I mean, more on this in a moment, but I grew up in the Mennonite community in Canada and did not know. Anyway, Kendi goes on to say this: "But whenever people rise up against bad things tend to get worse. You know the old saying, when the going gets tough, the tough get racist," or something like that. So all that anti-racist talk coming from the Mennonites was shut down because slaveholders didn't like their business talked about like it was wrong, because they needed their slaves, because their slaves made them money. It's really all quite simple." Close quote. Well, I did, as I said, grow up in that Mennonite tradition, not, you know, ears deep in it, just hip deep in it, because my dad was a Mennonite, but my mom wasn't. So this idea that the Mennonite people as a collective culture have a strong commitment to justice and peace building through nonviolent means isn't new to me. Nor is the fact that as a people group, the Mennonites have often been called the silent in the land. They don't tend to start with theatrics, unless you call things like living in colonies and, you know, not having buttons on your clothing theatrics or the enacting of something, which is worth thinking about. So here's a question. Is that petition from the 1600s, that anti-racist petition, anti-slavery petition, is that petition a prophetic voice? Well, here are some questions that follow on that for me. Does it raise the volume about something that isn't right? Does it sound like the collective voice of people that couldn't stay silent? Does it have the potential to speak truth to power about a needed corrective in understanding and in policy? Yes, it does. And that's what makes it a prophetic voice. One of the things that I found intriguing about this story is the way that it reveals that the people drafting the petition had an integrated view of the world in which they lived. They understood that you can't just hive off policy from religion, that one kind of oppression is connected to other kinds of oppression, just as surely as one expression of justice is connected to other expressions of justice. Why would that be the case? Now, you've been around this space any amount at all, you know that. You know a rhetorical question when one comes at you. That's a rhetorical question. We talked a few weeks ago about images other than war for responding to this COVID pandemic. And one of the stories I told in that conversation was of a documentary about a biodynamic farm in California. The documentary was called The Biggest Little Farm. This is a farm where the farmers understand that although the plants on the surface might look like disconnected individuals, the reality is that below the ground, their root systems send out messages to one another, including to other species, about what they need in order to thrive. And the other plants, and I didn't know this, the other plants respond by sending out the chemicals and the nutrients needed by the plants that sent the "we need help" messages. So it's not just like the message goes out, I'm starving for more nitrogen or something, and the other plants are like, "Man, that's unfortunate. We have enough." They actually send the things that are needed through the root system. And so I cited that original story as an example of people that see new pests or problems on the farm as evidence that something is out of balance, not simply as enemies to attack and destroy. And that understanding of the interconnected biome, I think, can help us see the integrated nature of the rest of life. And to me, that also sounds like a prophetic voice. And I think the reason it has that tone for me is because it points out that ideas and practices that disconnect the pieces of life from one another are things that need to be responded to. They need to not be glossed over or swept under the rug or policied to the sidelines, or if all that fails, to be shot or bombed or residential schooled into submission. If you were one of those Hebrew prophets we were considering a moment ago, you might say that the failure to do so, the failure to respond to those imbalances and those disconnects, may well result in what may look like a good vineyard growing what the Hebrew prophet Isaiah has the voice of the divine call bad grapes. That the garden might look pretty, but be growing bad fruit. The way the text actually reads in Isaiah is, why is this beautiful vineyard growing bad grapes? Prophetic voices have historically understood that everything is connected. Not least of all because these voices often sort of morph over into or blend with the mystic. And if there's one thing that the mystics have consistently said across different religions, across different racial origins, across different cultural origins, from all these different perspectives, one of the things that the prophets and the mystics keep saying to the rest of us is everything is connected. And we need to pay attention. Why is this beautiful vineyard growing bad grapes? Why does this thing that looks like it should be good, why is there bad fruit coming out of it? If you want to see an especially clear instance of this prophetic perspective that everything is connected, spend a little bit more time in the book of Isaiah. In that book, particularly in chapter 5, the prophets use the image of a vineyard to talk about their understanding of the divine vision of what a right world might look like. And in that vision, we find a world where it takes work to make what is good and right happen. The soil is fertile, the earth can provide for everyone, but it means you have to pick the rocks, you have to plant good plants, you have to tend them, you have to harvest them responsibly, and so on. There's an integral interwovenness to all of life. If you pull on one piece, the others move as well. This is why something inside of me just goes grr when I see religious signage that treats the idea of God like a magician. This idea, like, I think I saw a sign somewhere that was like, you know, may God keep you safe during the pandemic. Well, that's a lovely thought. May you wash your hands and wear your mask and use disinfectant and practice social distancing and keep yourself and other people safe during this pandemic. I don't know. The human experience, it seems to me, that is, if God lives anywhere, God lives in us. And so if God's going to keep us safe during this pandemic, we better do our part. We better pick the rocks. We better tend to the ground. We better take care of the vineyard, or there's going to be some bad fruit. That's the kind of image that the prophets are working with, right? And that's not just on the positive side. It's true on the downside as well. You may know, if you've been exposed to some of these writings, that if the Hebrew prophets saw the people who hold power misbehaving, they did not pull their punches. Listen to this. This is one of the Isaiahs. It's likely that there was more than one Isaiah, probably three at least at different times and in different geographic locations that all kind of get lumped together as Isaiah in our versions these days. But in any case, one of the ideas in this text that I'm going to read here is just letting the power holders have it. And the reason they're blasting them is because those who held the reins of power are doing things like usurping the ability of ordinary people to make a living. They are denying citizens access to fair judgments in court. The prophets lambaste them for profiting at the expense of those that are working hard to provide for their families. I mean, these are all things that sound so familiar. Anyway, there's these texts in Isaiah that start with woe too. And they have this tone about them. So this is one of those woe to texts. And we'll unpack it a little bit. Woe to you who add house to house and join field to field till no space is left and you live alone in the land. The Lord Almighty has declared in my hearing, quote, surely the great houses will become desolate, the fine mansions left without occupants. And then a few verses later, woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are, some of this stuff is, I mean, it's dark and it's darkly funny sometimes. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and champions at mixing drinks, who acquit the guilty for a bribe but deny justice to the innocent. Therefore, as tongues of fire lick up straw and as dry grass sinks down in the flames, so their roots will decay and their flowers blow away like dust. At another point in the book, the prophet talks about how if we don't attend to matters of justice, we will, quote, go into exile for lack of understanding, close quote. More on that in a moment. And by the way, I think lots of us have been taught things about justice and its connection to the divine. I mean, here's the prophet sort of saying, God said this, and I was in the room and I heard it, and so they're the voice of the divine to the people in their context. I think lots of us have been taught things about that relationship between the prophetic voice and the divine that are really harmful. And one of the most corrective ideas that I've bumped into in my own study of this is that when the prophets talk about justice, they are talking about consequence. They're talking about how, no matter how true it is that we are divinely loved, the work of tending to things is still ours to do, and if we don't do it, there are consequences, and they're quite natural consequences. So far, that might not sound especially interconnected. It might sound more like if you're rich and greedy and you ignore others, or you're partying, you're just pounding back the wine and mixing your drinks and going woohoo while the rest of the world is starving and not being given justice. Expect that to backfire at some point. And for the conflagration of that backfiring to consume what you thought was oh so permanent. This would be a natural consequence of that. These things are interconnected. And that's pretty sobering. Not least of all, when we consider it in light of the suddenly visible impermanence of so many things that might have felt, if not solid, then at least stable, only a very short while ago. Here's the interconnected part. So back to the Isaiah text. Therefore, my people will go into exile for lack of understanding. Those of high rank will die of hunger, and the common people will be parched with thirst. In other words, even if the injustice is most visibly perpetuated by those who hold the controls of the machinery of power, the devastation that follows from not attending to those issues comes to everyone. And if we have not yet seen that those that do not hold power suffer when the structures of power stumble and trip, then we have just not been paying attention at all. Who gets hit first and hardest? The people with the least cushion. Right? This is a natural consequence. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying there's a logic to it that we can easily see. The net result, the prophet tells the people, is that all this grand stuff that has been built on injustice and oppression will be left looking, he says, like a hut in a field of melons. Oh, man. Like all these mansions, you know, the ones that are going to be empty, they're just going to look like a hut in a field of melons. Actually, a number of translations say a field of cucumbers, which might be a little more Manitoban than melons. And that might not feel like a very meaningful image to us, but it was a really powerful one in its context, because the way this worked is that the hut that the prophet is talking about is a temporary structure. And we might call it a lean-to. It's a few twigs put together with some kind of fabric or hide or woven thing put over top of it to provide shelter for the workers that were hired to guard the crops from wild animals until they were ready to harvest. That's the hut that the prophet is talking about. And once the harvest is over, what happens to the hut is it just gets abandoned. It's not worth keeping. And so it just gets left, and eventually it just disintegrates and blows away in the wind. Nobody stays there. Nobody would want to stay there. You probably couldn't actually live there. In other words, it's the opposite of permanent. And that brings us back to the interconnectedness of it all. Not all prophetic responses look and sound like the thunder and fury of "it's all gonna burn," you know, that we sometimes encounter in some of these prophetic texts. But with or without the sound and fury, they all understand that everything is connected, and that when we pull on one part, the other parts move. So here's a question for me, and for you, and for all of us. What part can I pull on to move the whole? Can I hold up someone whose voice needs to be heard? Can I add my signature to a petition? Can that be my way of refusing to be silent? Can I be kind in some realm where unkindness is too often the norm? Can I check my privilege a bit more often and a bit more deliberately, even when the voice of the culture around me and the voice inside of me is saying, "It's your right"? Now, maybe you're wired to make big signs and put fresh batteries in your megaphone and take to the streets. Maybe you should do that. Maybe now's the time. But maybe you're not. Maybe I'm not. But as the prophets teach us, all the parts are connected. And if we can see that we're in a vineyard that's growing bad grapes instead of good fruit, if we can hear that things are out of tune and need to be tuned up, then it's our work to do. It's not somebody else's. It's not work that needs to be left to those who are noisily enraged. There's a place for that. There always has been. It's important. It's necessary. I can't help but think that at this moment in history, it's timely. And because everything is connected, so are all those other things important and necessary. All those other ways to respond, to engage, to participate. It's all connected. So let's find our part and see if we can make it move. Peace, everybody. It's been good to be with you all. I look forward to the next opportunity to do that this way, certainly. And as I've said before, we'll keep you posted about other possible ways we might be able to gather once we can sort of discern what a good, safe, caring path forward looks like in all of that for us as a community. In the meantime, grace and peace. Bye for now.